I'd like to get started, if you don't mind. So I'm Guy Behay. I'm Deputy Director of the Oxford Uhiro Center for Practical Ethics and the Oxford Center for Neuroethics, who are hosting this event. And welcome to the second annual lecture in neuroethics. And we're extremely pleased to have a speaker this year, Professor Jorge Moll from the DOR Institute for Research and Education from Brazil. Jorge was one of the very first to use neuroimaging, functional neuroimaging, to study the neural basis of moral cognition, and has since published many of the seminal articles in this area. And he will present his workshops tonight, and he will be speaking more specifically about neuroimaging evidence for the neural basis of moral sentiments, pro-social and antisocial.
Thank you very much, Guy and Julian, for this kind invitation. For me, it's an honor to be here talking to you. I hope to put some interesting ideas, and as you see, my work is a very experimental one, and of course you try to make it conceptually palatable and make sense to a larger audience. But of course there will be a lot of technical stuff, and I hope it not to burden you too much. But since I'm an incorrectible experimentalist, that's a bias you see that here. So please do not feel uncomfortable in interrupting me in the case if either my Brazilian English doesn't allow you to understand, or if I'm too hermetic in at some point, you can interrupt me. Although I think it's if you have questions at the end, it could work better. So I will present cover some of the earlier studies we did trying to address this very complicated issue, is how the brain represents morality. It's a very broad question, but I think in the past decades we have advanced significantly towards the same. Of course, this is just the beginning of the path. It's very preliminary work, I must say. But I'll cover our initial work just to give you a more like chronological idea also of how we've been thinking, and focus more on the more recent evidence for the neural basis of prosocial and antisocial behavior, presenting also, illustrating that with some clinical studies in patients. So this is just the outline. So in the first part, I'll cover this more conceptual issue of morality, then revise the functional imaging and some of the lesion studies, which point to which brain regions are and how they are assembled to enable morality. Then I cover the altruism and decision making, some paradigms and decision paradigms, and some patient studies. And at the very end, I covered a topic that we've been working for only 1 year now. It's a very, very initial thing, but I think it's a very interesting thing, which is brain decoding, how you can decode brain states and brain states related to morality and to moral emotions. So it is clear that we are moral creatures. We care a lot about moral issues. But morality didn't appear from out of the blue in our species. Morality evolved from several proto-morality, if you wish, that can be observed in several other social species. For example, in several primates, they show complex social behavior, such as forming coalitions, sharing foods, and keeping a score of cooperation, having reciprocity rules. But it is in humans that morality evolved to, you know, its most complex state. That the biological, probably the last biological major change in our species occurred in the Upper Paleolithic period, around 80 to 100,000 years ago. But after that, there was a big discussion also about how the biological nature interacts with this, the civilization and the forming of social values adopted by, you know, social groups, and how they interacted to bring about the, our present moral nature. So in humans, we observe these very complex moral manifestations, such as symbolic thinking, individual labor, economic exchange, the development of cultural norms. It's not surprising then that the brain sizes in humans suffered a huge increase in terms of volume from the earlier hominid species to the modern humans, say from 400 cc to 1.5 liters of brain capacity, the volume of the brain. It's a very costly organ, consumes 20% of our energy in the resting state. So we need powerful brains, actually, to be able to be moral. Of course, nothing. Our brain is not doing only morality, but it's a core phenomenon for our nature. So we humans, we care about lots of types of rewards and motivations, which are on the base of our immediate interests. However, our species is unique in terms of caring about very complex social and moral feelings. Many of them so are able to admire or to engage into actions which are far from subserving like our immediate interests. Some of them very complicated. For example, attaching to football teams, for example, is a very, very strange thing, isn't it? Or religious symbols, or and whatsoever, music. That's, for those who don't know, is Tom Jobim and Vinicius de Moraes, the father of Bossa Nova. So morality from a scientific perspective. So our take on addressing morality from a scientific perspective is very different from the philosophical perspective, which aims to define which are the universal principles that should guide human conduct. So which is the assembly of principles that could should guide human conduct. Whereas the scientific view aims, at least at this point, to document the changes in moral behavior and how brain regions respond or interact to enable moral behavior. So this is based on functional imaging in lesion studies. So this, let's put this division very clear, because these are the studies that provide the major inferences in the major dimensions of cognition and behavior. So that's the aim of science, to tease apart and to be reductionistic. There's no other way than to be reductionistic, but also with being careful not to get lost in the midst of the trees, because over-reductionism, of course, is also a dangerous thing. The aim, in the end, is to better understand our moral nature and to provide alleviation for neuropsychiatric disorders and other mental disorders which actually impair moral behavior and also impair, put society at risk, for example, antisocial behaviors. So, for the whole past century, all the attention has been, you know, the spotlight of morality has been the frontal lobes. You know, the famous case of Phineas Gage, and then all the work by Esslinger and Damasio when they saw the EVR case more recently, and brought this discussion back to the realm of science. So that was our starting point to study morality with functional imaging. So can we study morality with functional imaging? So just a little bracket about functional imaging. So a few words on that. In the past two decades, functional imaging, especially fMRI, it provided caused a tremendous advance in our understanding of several cognitive abilities, and morality included. So it's non-invasive, allows for multiple experimental designs and conditions, and you can repeat experiments with not no risks for the volunteers. So this was a major development. So functional imaging and spatial fMRI, for those who are not familiar, is based on acquisition of series of images from the brain and over time. Each set of, say, 30 slices over the brain is collected in about 2 seconds. So then we repeat this over time. And during this time, we can perform tasks. And the signal we measure in the brain is actually oxygenation of the hemoglobin. So when I move my hands, my contralateral motor cortex is more active, and that causes a recruitment of arterial blood, and the arterial blood has oxygenated hemoglobin, which has a slightly higher signal than the deoxygenated hemoglobin, and this can be picked up by the correct, appropriate imaging sequences in fMRI. So in the end, we're measuring transient changes in oxygenation in the brain induced by whatever task you're doing. So there is no real baseline state in the brain. That's very important. We're always comparing one condition to the other, although we can measure networks and synchronization among regions in the resting states, as you might have heard. But if you compare conditions between them, there's no true baseline. We're always comparing one condition to the other. So this is just a quick example of, say, someone is looking at this cross, central cross, then they would see a screen like this. And after several trials, repeating that, we do a statistical test with the signal, and we come up with these so-called activation maps, in this case, localizing activation on the primary visual cortex. So that's the basis of fMRI. So that was the first study we did on moral judgment. So that our first take on mapping morality in the brain, in a very crude way, very simple way, was just asking people in the scanner to make silent, mentally judge statements like those, telephones never ring, or statements like those, they hung an innocent man, and compare what is different between them. So they have to mentally judge that as right or wrong, and then afterwards we compare the moral condition to the factual condition, and that's the first picture we got from the group results. So this is activation on the anterior part of the frontal lobes, the so-called frontopolar cortex, which is actually one of the regions that is more developed in humans. So it has a huge expansion in our species compared to other primates. We also found activation in other regions. For example, the anterior temporal region, as you can see there on that upper slide, the lateral part of the brain. At the time, we had no explanation for that, but it already told us that the story was not so simple as, you know, the frontal lobe story would say. Of course, these first studies, they were uncontrolled for several aspects. For example, emotional valence was clearly different. It was higher in the moral condition than in the control condition. So further experiments aimed to piece this apart. So we controlled them in the next experience for emotional valence. Again, we find this temporal activation. In this case, the region called the STS is a superior temporal sulcus. It's a multimodal region which integrates, it's known to integrate several perceptual channels, modalities, to bring about, for example, the perception of body movements or gestures engage this region. And we also got, again, the ventral part of the frontal lobe when it compared equivalent situations with equivalent emotional valence, but which differed in terms of moral content. Just, I forgot to say that our definition of moral saliency or moral content was based on the Kolbe and Kohlberg definition, issues that are related to rights, responsibilities, or values. So we had a morality score for each kind of stimulus. So we had ratings on that. Okay, so at this time, it's still widely held belief that the frontal lobes, they have to do only with the executive or active functions. So one question that was raised was that, are these other frontal lobes engaged just because you're making active moral judgments? You're, you know, actively trying to discriminate or to weight these situations. So we designed this study, which was totally passive study, in which we showed pictures which were previously scored or rated by a separate set of subjects in terms of moral content. So we had sets of pictures which had high moral content and were negatively valence, and also pictures which are evoked also negative emotions, but had very relatively low moral content. So we presented these pictures to subjects, of course the neutral pictures as well, scrambled, and then just told them to pay attention to the pictures, and we showed them one after the other. And what we got is that if we look at pictures which are emotionally negative together, irrespective if they are moral or non-moral, we get bilateral amygdala responses and brainstem responses, all these base of the brain regions which respond to emotional arousal. But when we contrast directly the moral pictures to the unpleasant non-moral pictures, we get again VA10, frontal polar cortex, and the STS, the superior temporal cortex region, and also the anterior temporal lobe is not shown here. They are engaged. So this piece of evidence actually started to tell us a different story about moral judgments, is that if you face a morally relevant or salient situation, your brain is already tuned to that as a network. These regions are engaged all together. In this study, we did also a connectivity analysis, and we showed that this frontal region and the STS, and upper frontal regions, they are more connected to each other, functionally connected, when you presented these pictures with moral contents. So we developed this idea of moral sensitivity, that we are attuned, you know, we are actually like a radar monitoring with our moral brain is active all the time. You know, of course, it suffers fluctuations over time, depending if you detect more irrelevant issues. And later on, I'll show that this architecture of functional architecture of morality matches what is being studied now as these resting state networks. Okay, so just to move on. So summarize, there were several studies over the last decade, and all of them reached to very similar, they point to very similar arrangement or engagement of regions, irrespective of the type of test, was active test, passive test, if they use pictures, simple moral judgments, difficult moral dilemmas, and etc. So you have this more functional architecture of morality, which is remarkably stable. It's not actually task dependent. That's the take home message. So the next step was to organize this. How are these regions? What do they do actually? So why they are, is it just, you know, it's a whole network, but each region must have a role and must have a combination of roles with the other regions. So we did a careful, detailed revision of the literature, searching for cases in which patients developed changes in moral behavior. And if you just, you know, just not looking at frontal lobes, for example, just looking for lesions leading to change in moral behavior. And the, what do we get from that is that it is far from, you know, it's not the frontal lobes. There are a lot of impairments which are induced by, for example, anterior temporal lobe damage, which is very common, for example, in frontotemporal dementia and also trauma, car accidents, for example. They damage the frontal lobe and also the anterior temporal lobes very often. And these cases develop sometimes very bizarre types of social behavior, loss of empathy, and etc. And also damage to small structures in the subcortical regions, such as the septal region and hypothalamus, and etc. These regions are very delicate, and they evolve in awareness as well. So big lesions in there, of course, lead to death. But when patients survive, when they have capricious, strategic lesions in there, they can develop extreme changes in moral behavior. So, for example, violent assaults and anger bursts and sexual activity, which is absolutely inappropriate, and etc., with tiny, tiny changes in these subcortical regions. So clearly the story goes away from the frontal lobes at the seat of morality. So morality seems to be a distributed function of the brain, but it's not just, you know, everywhere. So here's a depiction of the regions for which we have clear evidence, both from functional imaging and from lesion studies, which are involved in moral behavior. So we can see the frontal polar cortex, the right dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, which is kind of less clear, and the medial and lateral orbitofrontal at the ventral region of the brain, these regions here, and the anterior temporal cortex. That's so. And of course, then the limbic regions, the subcortical limbic regions, including the septal area, in addition to the amygdala, hypothalamus, and the basal forebrain structures. So that seems okay. So this is a lot of the brain, but if you look at the regions whose lesions do not lead to moral impairments, it's a lot of the brain as well. So one could say that the emergence of morally abnormal behaviors, they arise from specialized combination of lesions, not combination, but in special regions. It's not everywhere in the brain. Okay, so if we look now at what these regions in which lead to moral impairments, what they are doing, we came up with a simplification scheme, so a very schematic thing. But there are these four main components in terms of the cognitive abilities, cognitive emotional abilities that these regions are important. So the green one, so perspective assessments, so value assessment of goals, assessment of future rewards, and etc. This here, conceptual social knowledge. So forgot to say, so the perspective assessments. Frontal lobes are absolutely important for us to enable us to think about tomorrow, what we're going to do, and to weigh options in the future. Conceptual social knowledge was a hypothesis at the time. We did experiments to investigate this, but it's clear that anterior temporal lobes are important in conceptual social knowledge. Patients with atrophy in these regions, they progressively lose their ability to discriminate object categories, and they also lose social information, social knowledge. Then the more posterior regions, like the STS, superior temporal cortex, they represent actual perceptual and sensory. So, for example, face, body expression, voice, they enable us to capture, for example, body posture and facial emotions very rapidly and integrate this into our behavior. And finally, but not less importantly, the basic instinctive motivation emotions,
which are, we could say that it's
free floating anxiety or anger or attachment, pleasure or pain,
for which the limbic, the subcortical regions are absolutely fundamental. So just putting this back into the brain, we could actually summarize this as the central motive state. That's an idea that Elliot Steller came up in the 50s based on stimulation of hypothalamic and neighboring regions, which if you stimulate electrically these regions, you can induce several types of emotional states, very strong ones, but they are free-floating. They have no object, they are decontextualized. So the central motive states, aggression, anxiety, attachment, etc., in the subcortical regions. Then the social features and the social functional features in the temporal lobe, and then the prefrontal cortex. And here we adopted Jordan Grattman's model of the prefrontal cortex, which he calls the structure of knowledge. Which is a representational model of the frontal cortex. Instead of being the frontal cortex being somewhat a structure which is operating or acting on knowledge represented in other areas only, like a managerial thing or executive thing, it's actually representing information, but especially sequential information. So we present a sequence of actions, abstract or motoric actions. And all these things, all these regions, they must work together. So just come back to that. So they must work together in a non-hierarchical way. They must be synchronized. So for a complex moral emotion, for example, or evaluation, you have to integrate these regions. And probably this is unproved. We need to seek evidence for that yet. But we suspect that this mechanism operates in the same way that Wolf Singer proposed for example, for visual binding. Binding, if you have a perception, visual perception of motion and objects and, you know, shape and motion at the same time, which occur in different brain posterior regions, but they are synchronized in the gamma band. So it's a temporal synchronization. Only electrophysiology can actually tell us about this. But it's very likely that these regions act together by temporal binding. Okay, so what are the implications of these outlines of evidence to our understanding of moral cognition? So we believe that they provide potentially an improvement over these hierarchical models of control, of top-down control or bottom-up control. I mean, such as, for example, somatic markers. So viscera putting up in, you know, inducing us to be in certain states, and then from there we react in certain ways. Or reason suppressing emotions and enabling us to act morally. So these classical hierarchical models, such as the MacLean model, they are still very popular because they are they are very intuitive. So in this, for example, in this model, we have the more basic region, the primitive brain or archipelium, so the reptile brain, which is the emotional brain. And then we have a further cover in, say, the paleomammalian brain, which allows, represented by the limbic structures. We actually have the emotions, not only the self-preservation mechanism. And then the cortical would be the rational. And the cortex would actually control the beasts we have inside us in our limbic system. So we have to suppress these urges that come from the depths of our brain to act appropriately. So this view is actually wrong anatomically. You know, it's not because of, you know, that's outside our discussion of morality, but the function architecture of the brain and evolution of the brain doesn't work at all in layers. So what happens in, for example, in our, in the development of our species, that several nuclei, subquartal nuclei, which are considered to be primitive, they grill together with the cortical structures. They grill, they grow like a radial networks. They grow together. So there are several allometric studies looking at these regions, subcortical regions. They grow in our species even in more than several cortical areas. So functional integration instead of top-down control would be one possibility to better explain. Of course, this has been tested experimentally to better explain our moral behavior, as well as several other cognitive abilities. So it's just one example how emotions like compassion could emerge. So if you suppose that you're visiting an orphanage and you see this sad girl, so then you activate your STS because of the body posture, her facial expression, etc. You can, you know, she is, for example, 10 years old, and you can you automatically engage conceptual representations, for example, of helplessness and loneliness. It's abstract conceptual representations. And your frontal lobe, especially the poles, the frontal polar cortex, allows you to immediately think about the future of this girl. So, okay, the chance of adoption are small at this age. So, what's the future of this child, and etc. And finally, then you engage your subcortical regions, which might enable you to feel attachment, feelings of attachment. So all these things happen together, and they have this network activity, which actually enables us to feel compassion. So there is no localization, but you have a combined activation. So I just want to point to this quickly. We are still, you know, starting to do these kinds of experiments, but I think it's an interesting idea that can be combined. So there was a lot of research now showing that several regions of the brain depicted here, but this work was conducted by Marcus Raico, showing these regions, they are active when we are doing nothing, when we are just resting. Of course, we are never resting, we are just having our own inner thoughts, but these networks are strongly engaged when you're doing this, and once you are required to do some specific task, these regions actually deactivate. So it's the evidence, there's a lot of evidence for that. Turns out that these regions are exactly, or they are very, very close to the moral cognition network. So one could suppose that we are, you know, when you're in a relaxed state and, you know, say walking or not doing a specific task, we engage actually these networks, and they enable us to be monitoring all the social reality and the moral implications. And we have some. So, okay, just this exercise. If you think about one of the best, happiest moments of your life, or one of the worst or most sad episodes in your life. So what happens, and this is exactly what we did in this study. So we studied 15 normal volunteers while they were thinking about autobiographical episodes, which are related to family, related to significant others, and either positive or negative episodes emotionally. So what you see up there, the blue, is what the regions of the brain which are active in the resting state compared to a 7-back. 7-back is like counting, subtracting sevens from, say, 100. And it's a mathematical task and it takes a lot of resources, cognitive resources. So if you can compare rest to counting back, that these are the regions we get. However, if you compare when you entertain pleasant autobiographical memories,
That's what you get. The red thing and the pink thing, which is the overlapping with the resting condition.
Even here is the negative memories.
So it's actually the same set of regions. It's very similar. There's a small difference between positive and negative, but there's a great overlap in these affiliative, in this case, affiliative emotional states in the resting brain. I'll skip through this, and then I move to the neural basis of altruistic decisions. So these are more recent experiments. So one question would be, was at the time, so we have these more cognition networks, it's engaged, it's one thing, I mean, it's a distributed thing, it doesn't matter what kind of emotion you're feeling, it's just the same sort of thing. So we designed this study to evoke specific moral emotions. We designed scenarios which could evoke, for example, guilt. Your mother calls you one night telling you she was not feeling well and you did not take her seriously. The next day she died. Okay, so this evokes guilt in most people, this in an imagery task, or statements, inducing indignation. We had also compassion and embarrassment. What we learned from this study was there was no specific signature for any moral emotion. But if we put together prosocial moral emotions, emotions that enable us to act more prosocially, including guilt, compassion, and embarrassment, to care about our mistakes or prevent mistakes towards others, we see that the anterior PFC, which is the frontopolar cortex, is highly activated in these emotions, as well as the superior STS region. Again, the same regions that we see in moral judgments. However, when we look at other blaming emotions, such as indignation and disgust, we see activation of the lateral occipital cortex, which is a region that is highly involved in, for example, in disgust and even perceptual disgust. If you feel bad taste, you engage the lateral occipital cortex. So clusters of emotions, of social emotions, evoke different patterns. But there are some, if you cluster them differently, then we can find commonalities. So for example, if you look at the empathic emotions, guilt and compassion, these emotions, what do they have in common? Both of them are about others. We care about the well-being of others. So when you look at them, you see these basal forebrain hypothalamic regions, which at the time we had trouble to interpret, but the story came out more clear in more recent experiments, as I show. So I'll show this. This is a work by my colleague Roland Zahn, and the purpose of this study was to look at these anterior temporal regions, which we didn't have much evidence for that. What is this anterior temporal cortex doing exactly? So his idea was that it was storing some kind of social conceptual knowledge. But for that, he used this kind of experiments. So people were presented with social functional concepts. For example, stingy generals, coward, brave, and compared to other concepts, other abstract concepts, which are animal function, useful, nutritious, dangerous, poisonous. So what we get is this superior anterior temporal cortex. So this region seems to be specialized for these, say, traits or social concepts, which are very important for our ability to judge situations in an abstract way. So this is a further study in which we had the same social concepts, but then in the context of action. So you acted stingily or generously towards your best friend. So when you do that, you get, again, the same activity on the your temporal cortex here, because it's semantic, social semantics, and it doesn't care about what kind of emotion is involved. However, if you look then at the limbic, so the subcortical and the frontal regions, then these regions are specific for, they react differently for different
more emotions evoked,
such as guilt and indignation, as we saw before, but with a more precise design. Okay, I skip through this, and I move to this study, the charitable donation study. So far, we're only talking about moral cognition studies using abstract scenarios and or pictures and things like that. So the aim of this study was actually to put morality, you know, on the rolls, and so to have some reality on that, even in the context of, in the very artificial context of an MRI scanner. So in this study, we had people, volunteers, recruited, and they could win. They were told that their decisions could lead to monetary gains for themselves. It was real money. They could earn as much as $128. They made these decisions anonymously, and they were told that they could keep all the money for themselves, or they could donate, depending on the past trial, to different causes. And we, on purpose, we chose causes, some of them that could be very controversial. For example, abortion, euthanasia, armed gun control, at National Rifle Association, for example, and things like that. So by doing that, we wanted to see if people would sacrifice money to help certain causes, or to oppose certain causes. The test design allowed us also to look at opposition, because depending on the payoffs, if they wanted to keep the money, money would be donated by the funds to the organization. So they also could sacrifice to oppose, costly opposition, for example. Or they could donate costly, for example. Or they can just win money. There were some trials that the organization didn't lose or win. They could just win money. So these participants, on average, they donated 40% of the whole stake. That ranged from 20 to 80%, a big range across people. But these are the functional imaging results. So what we see, it's called a conjunction analysis. So what we see here are the brain regions which are active, either when they are winning money with no consequences for the organization, or when they are donating money. So we see here VTA is a ventral tegmental area, is the source of the dopaminergic neurons to the ventral striatum, which is this region here. So this is basically the reward system of our brains. So when people win money, everybody knew that. There were several studies at the time using financial rewards. You activate the reward system. But this study was the first to demonstrate that when you are donating money, you activate also the reward system of the brain. So is helping only like a reward response, or do we see certain specificity in brain systems? So that was done by comparing directly the donation condition to the reward condition. Then by doing that, we saw activation in this very deep area, the subgeneral cortex, and that tiny spot there, back there, which is the septal regions. So these regions, they are very intimately related to bonding behaviors in several species. They are very dense, they have very dense presence of receptors for oxytocin, vasopressin. So they're related to very basic attachment mechanisms. So what this tells us is that probably the basic attachment mechanism that, you know, allows several species, mothers to attach to pups, for example, or pair bonding, they act in our species to allow us to attach to very complex causes and principles or even ideologies. So when people oppose situations, then they engage the lateral or prefrontal cortex, which was the region that we saw that's involved in disgust and in indignation. So that's the correlate. So it tells us that it's a culturally mediated social aversion engage the same systems as aversion to bad tastes, for example.
And when we just look at costly decisions, if you're either if you're opposing or you're donating, and then in this situation we get back the frontal polar cortex that we saw before for moral judgments. So this region is more strongly engaged when you have to make a real decision, which is costly.
Okay, so this other experiment done by my colleague Frank Kruger was a neuroeconomic experiment. So I want to show this quickly because I think it's very informative in this topic. Here we had two people interacting, each one in a different scanner. And they were doing like a prisoner's dilemma game, but it was iterative. So each one, you know, made decisions the first time, then the other one could reciprocate the cooperation, and etc. Then they switched the roles. And okay, so basically, to summarize, when we analyze the patterns of interaction between the subjects, the vast majority of them, the pairs, 22 pairs of people. Cooperated most of the time. There were only two pairs who actually started to fight, and actually they lost all the money. They started to fight and punish each other. Okay, so we discovered these two subjects from the analysis, and what we see here is the people in general cooperated because they took profits from this cooperation. However, there were two different pairs. About half of them developed a kind of conditional cooperation, like a they only cooperated if the gains of the specific interaction were good for both. So in certain instances, the payoff for the first decision maker was very high, and this person defected. Still, they were able to pick up cooperation again. And the other half had unconditional cooperation. They cooperated every single time, irrespective of the bonus involved in the given trial. So here we show that what the regions of the brain which are most synchronized or co-activated in their brains when they are making cooperation decisions. So the behavior is exactly the same. They are cooperating with the other one, but these are the unconditional cooperators or the trust-based cooperators. And here are the conditional cooperators. So what we see here, although they are making the same decision to cooperate, these guys are activating the reward system, the VTA regions. So probably they are focused on the expected gains, financial gains, whereas the other ones are activating the septal region, which is the region related to bonding mechanisms. So in this case, the brain is telling us something that cannot be observed in the behavior in a given trial. So this is more recent data. This is still unpublished data, but we wanted to look. We are very interested now in the septal region. So it really seems to be a core region to enable us to feel for others, a very basic region. And in this study, we had scenarios which are affiliative. They describe you interacting in positive or in negative ways towards your kin. And we had scenarios, control scenarios, which are also social and emotional, but they don't involve kin interactions. And the results, I just want to show this quickly. We see very strong activations here in this region of the hypothalamus and septal region. So this region is really involved in these kinds of affiliative behaviors or affiliative feelings in this case. So we got supported data from lesion, from this lesion study. This study was done with a sample from the NIH. So these are patients with the behavioral type of frontotemporal dementia. Typically, these patients, they have a dementia which starts earlier than the Alzheimer's one, starts on the 40s and 50s or 60s. They typically develop impaired social functioning. They start to shoplift, for example. They start to have inappropriate sexual behavior. They start start with teasing behaviors. And that's the first manifestation of this disorder.
So we started a sample of 21 patients with these, and we were interested to see
whether we could get evidence for these motor emotions being affected in a selective manner, depending on the topography of the atrophy, in this case the hypometabolism using PET imaging. So what we see here are the regions which are parametrically hypometabolic in relation to impaired prosocial emotions. So the task involves showing the scenarios as I described before, and then in this case they have to pick which emotion matches they would feel in that specific situation. So the more impaired they are in the prosocial emotions such as guilt and embarrassment and compassion or pity, the more hypometabolism they have in the frontotemporal cortex in the central regions. And differently, the more impaired they are in indignation and disgust, the more atrophy they have in the amygdala in the dorsal medial region of the cortex.
So we can really discriminate these networks on the basis of this dysfunction in these patients. Okay. I want to mention psychopathy. That's another kind of subject we've been studying. In our case, in Rio, it's very dangerous to study patients, criminal individuals in prisons, because the system is not so safe as you might imagine. So we decided, my colleague Ricardo de Oliveira Souza is a neuropsychiatrist, but he sees these patients in a psychiatric institution. These individuals, they come normally, generally they are brought from their families because they are, destroying the family, they are destroying the financial resources, creating a lot of problems. And at some point the family is, okay, you have to have a psychiatric consultation, then they come to consultation. So these are what we call the community psychopaths. Of course, not all of them are psychopaths. Many of them have other psychiatric disorders, but then we have the assessment and we have a sample, an increasing sample of these subjects. Of course, they leave at some point, they never stay. But we had the opportunity to study a number of them. And psychopathy has been studied before by several investigators using manual tracing of regions, especially the frontal cortex and the hippocampus. And so most of the studies show small volumetric decreases in the frontal cortex, but overall their brains look pretty much normal. So our aim here was to use a more advanced technique at the time, which was the voxel-based morphometry, to look at the whole brain instead of selecting regions. And it turns out that the regions here, the regions in yellow and red, are the regions which are reduced. They have cortical reductions in these regions relative to a paired sample of normal controls. And the reduction, the degree of abnormality in these regions in the frontal cortex and the STS is related to the severity of their scores in the psychopathy checklist. So there seems to be a monotonic relationship between the atrophy and how how psychopathic they are. So that's come to the last part of my talk. So just speak about a few slides on brain encoding. So the parent recognition methods in functional and structural imaging and the methods to classify patients and classify brain states using these more modern techniques, algorithms. So the first, just a little bit of the theoretical grounds of this. So discrimination, we seek to find discriminative information using multivariate tools. So instead of looking at one voxel and comparing, say, populations or conditions, we're looking at the combined effects of several voxels in the brain using two main methods.
the linear discrimination analysis, and the support vector machines. There are a number of researchers have been doing fantastic work on this in the past few years, trying to, for example, look at a representation of objects. They can do like brain reading and decode, for example, if you're thinking about the hammer or if you're thinking about a house and etc. And we started to use these techniques actually in the sample of psychopaths to try to see if the structural images could be used to discriminate between psychopaths and normal controls. It turns out that we reached about 80% of sensitivity and specificity in telling apart a normal control from the psychopath. Of course, this is not good enough for clinical applications, but it has ethical implications, and it has and already tells that these kinds of imaging can be used for a prediction and will have a lot of implication in the future. Okay, and now I jump to the neurofeedback part of the story. So this is the thing that we are most interested now is, can we train, complex emotional states in the brain? So can you make people train this, but having some objective marker in the brain? So in this study, this is actually preliminary data that I'm showing here, but we had volunteers picking as I showed the data in the data before, choosing autobiographical memories from their own lives, of course, autobiographical, which could be pleasant or unpleasant, very relevant ones, and they had to engage in these memories voluntarily. We just cued them. Pleasant or unpleasant, and also asking them to think about affiliative memories, because we are interested in the affiliation networks. We also had autobiographical neutral episodes, and what we did is that we collected the data. The subject is in the scanner. We tell them, okay, think about, we project their pleasant, and they think about if it's pleasant memories, unpleasant, and so on. Mixed up with the neutral ones. Then we developed a software system which can do this very quickly. They can align the images, do a general linear model, calculate the difference between the tasks, do a feature selection map, and then train those voxels which survive this statistics with a support vector machine with some multivariate algorithm. So in the end, what we have is a trained set of a network which can be used for prediction. And this is done in a couple of minutes. So as soon as one finished the acquisition period, this run, then 2 minutes later, we start again. But this time, we show the subject these rings here. And the distorted ring means that the person is engaging in the state, which is actually not discriminating between the two states. It's distorted, and the more the person achieves the desirable, the goal states, it could be the pleasant state or the unpleasant state, this ring becomes more perfect, so it becomes more smooth. So it's a very interesting feeling, actually. If you're in the scanner, you can see that ring, and it moves according to your imagination of the scenarios. And I can show you... okay, that's actually my own brain. I was thinking here, this is our son, from Nazir. So Francisco was in the hospital, so I was imagining the scene. It was very stressful at this time. And then the pleasant one, just for playing, he was looking at his own brain activity in a study that actually he did. So these two scenarios, and then I show a little movie for you to give you an idea of how can you observe Okay, instead of showing, you know, brain activity, which is very complicated, we can show, we can transform very complex brain patterns in interpretable data.
This is an earlier version of the new feedback system we had, and you see that the red thing in the occipital cortex is starting to build up. So here the subject is imagining these affiliative scenarios. And next you see actually the current implementation we have. So this is unpleasant. It's projected backwards because it's projected to the subject in the scanner. The subject only sees this screen here. So as you see the circle, the ring becomes, you know, in this case, perfect. That's the best SVM projection.
So we can monitor. So the subject can actually have a feedback on their own performance in the task and potentially train to achieve desirable states. So I believe this is a very interesting tool that can be used potentially for any kind of emotional states or morally relevant states, attitudes, and so on. Okay, just to conclude. Yeah, that's Eduardo, our other son. Of course, there are easier ways to reach these states, but we don't have objective markers. So the big advantage of NSS methods is that we might have very objective markers, and on the top of that, we can train subjects to reach psychological states based on other populations. So, if, for example, experts in reaching very positive emotional states or tranquility or meditative states, for example, we can have these goal brain patterns, and we can train subjects to try to get to the same levels and have objective markers. So to conclude, in the last 10 years, it was found that there is a stable networks of neural components which are engaged in moral sentiments, in moral judgments, in decision-making tasks, with a big variety of tasks, types of tasks and stimuli. The integration, we believe that integration of cortical and subcortical networks can better accommodate how our brain operates, especially in terms of moral cognition. And that leads us beyond these cognition-emotional dualism and suppression of one to the other, and it might be helpful in understanding more complex motivations and emotions. We find overlapping networks which represent moral sentiments, values, and altruistic decisions, although we can also see some differences between these things. That's, I think, a big challenge now is to find descriptive signatures for these complex states. We found that the septal region, the frontopolar cortex, subgeneral cortex, are key, very key regions for the prosocial emotions, and I would say for morality. Pattern recognition methods and neurofeedback, they are able to predict categories of patients, for example, and they are a window into the subjective emotional states. We can potentially train several types of states, such as gratitude, for example, determination, tolerance, and so on, or decrease of anxiety. And our growing ability to predict behavior, of course, has deep implications for diagnostic treatment of neuropsychiatric disorders, and also legal implications, ethical implications. Tailoring better behaviors using all sorts of manipulation, pharmacology, and surgical interventions, neurofeedback, it's fundamental that we understand the organization of these complex neurocognitive networks. And applications are, as you might imagine, can be very wide, including, you know, policymakers treating couples, for example, couples problems, or organizational psychology, and so on. So I would just like to thank, this is a big group effort. Studies are very complex, so we depend on a lot of people working together from the computational side, from the neurological and the MRI, and I was thank my all of my collaborators from different places, especially João Sato and Roland Zahn. These are our people from the lab, from the institute, and I leave you with some nice pictures of Lagoa in Rio de Janeiro. Thank you.
We have time for questions.
Yeah, so you mentioned fMRI lesion studies. Have there been any stimulation studies of the mold brain? What does it show?
Yeah, the stimulation studies. There is one study that I am aware of. Okay, there are simulation studies not aiming at, you know, studying the moral brain, but surgical studies, for example, for epilepsy and things like that, in which insertion of catheters in the third ventricle when they touch, for example, regions of the hypothalamus, the patients can have pleasurable sensations, they can have anger bursts. So these are just clinical observations. But I'm only aware of one study done in Parkinson's patients with deep electrode implants, which I don't know if it's already published. But it was a very confusing study. And I would say, no, there are no convincing studies on manipulation of moral states with simulation. This definitely is would be very interesting.
Thank you. All very interesting. But the most interesting thing for me was the comment you made about the resting state. That the resting state, at least of the cortex, is the area of the cortex that seems to be stimulated in moral thought. Could you give us a bit more information about that? For instance, in particular, do those resting states map onto the deeper part of the brain, so the amygdala and the septum? Are they also the parts of the brain that are stimulated in resting states? And also, how robust is that across, say, different cultural groups?
Oh, cultural groups, yeah, that's unsure, but I would say that, yes, the resting state is a very interesting story. Although the resting state studies, they were done, most of them, I think all of them, without really controlling or trying to have a more in-depth view on what people are thinking about when they're resting.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of work to be done. We know, we can, you know, with folk knowledge, we can guess what people are thinking about their lives. There are people who are thinking about the future, or what they did, what they should do, what they have to do. So that's all the contents of of our thoughts, isn't it?
Well, I suppose one worry I have is that the resting state, I mean, you're in an MRI scanner for the start. And I wonder how robust it is that you are really resting, or are you in some sort of heightened emotional state?
So, yeah. So, my guess is that you are engaged in very complex thinking.
Yeah.
You are. So, that's it. But the resting state studies have not addressed this.
Okay.
All resting. But
yeah, sure.
And I think that the resting state is the function anatomy tells us that the moral condition network is very, very overlapping with the resting state. I think we are, maybe, if we are in a positively, in an eudaimonic moral state, open, you know,
yeah,
listening and being open to others' feelings and opinions, and, you know, I think this is the state that resembles mostly the resting state,
yeah,
isn't it? So,
it's totally different when you're solving a task. Even solving a moral dilemma, an official moral dilemma, yeah. There is a different mind state.
So would you, just as a final comment, would you suggest that the resting state as a baseline for all fMRIs is actually not understood enough?
Definitely.
Okay.
Wouldn't you say that, a lot of people sitting in fMRI is probably resting, they may think very petty things, so they're not very moral.
Yeah.
Would you say what you're showing is into that?
It's
that's
true.
A social
yeah.
cognition
yeah.
network, and the moral network is just overlapping with that.
It's true.
It would be social thinking of completely immoral or amoral kind.
It's true. Things are, which are important to people, right? So there, but that could be tied to their own personal morality. So this is so the values they adopt and they have, and the goals they have, and things like that. Yeah.
What I didn't get was a feeling for the sort of the patient-specific variability. So the way you display your data, it conveys the impression that everyone lights up at the same time in the same way. I'm sure this can't be true.
Yeah.
So how do you actually display the variability in your data and the difference between responses?
So all these, up until now, 99% of the studies using fMRI, they look at commonalities. So it's actually kind of exploratory thing. So what is common between people, across people when they are doing such kind of tasks? If you look at the individual data, it tends to be very noisy. But that has been improving as technique improves. So right now, so for example, the neurofeedback data was showing is an example of how you can start to look at real individual data. But if you want to learn, I have a very complex task, a very complex, mental state or cognitive task, and normally what people want to know is what is common across people, because people can use actually different, they can have different associations and they use different strategies to solve the same task. So that's a problem with functional engineering. It's a noisy methods. If you just look at
there's different. It may be experimental noise, or it may just be variability between.
No, it's true. Yeah, exactly. So if you have a nice parameter, I didn't show, but I had one parameter in this affiliation study, which was individual scores on how much each people in a given social scenario they thought about future outcomes, and if you plug in. We have a very specific hypothesis for that, that the more people engage in future thinking about different outcomes, the more the frontal polar cortex would be activated. Because you think it's really linked to representing perspective alternatives. And it turns out that was the single most region responsive to this parameter. So you can indeed, if you have a nice parameter and you capture this in the behavior there, you can explore the correlates in the brain. Instead of just categorical. Yeah.
I'm interested in the work you mentioned on separating out psychopath from non-psychopath within the neuroimager. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about what tasks or conditions you use to kind of train the support vector machine to be able to differentiate the two.
Yeah. So in the beginning, when we started studying psychopaths, we decided not to do functional MRI on them, because after a couple of trials, one subject, for example, was in the scanner. He understood perfectly what the test was about. He was there, and at the end, okay, so how is it? I decided to close my eyes. I was tired. That's a typical psychopath. So I just didn't care about it. And then, so it's very tricky. I have trouble interpreting functional data from psychopaths if you have a specific test. How do you compare this activity to your controls, which have totally different motivations to be in the scanner than the psychopath, for example? So all the data I presented in psychopaths here are actually structural data. It's only structural. It's like cortical thickness.
quite so densely. Classifications of that was based on structure, on but not in functional.
I'm just interested in the definition you used for what is moral and what's not moral, because it seems there's a loop there.
Yeah.
You start out with what seems to be quite intuitive, off-the-shelf definition of morality. That may not necessarily link up with how the brain actually works. So how do you take account of that?
Yeah, that was of course a big discussion that we had, you know, we always had, and if you know, like, talking to you know some philosophers, they would you know some of them would tell us, oh, you have to commit to a doctrine. So I use Aristotelian or you know as a deontology, but the problem is that I don't think that the brain adopts moral theories. So what we adopt it was like a folk and actually the old definition of morality that the Greeks had. So it's the sets of customs and values that people that people follow in the people find important to follow, and they used to judge behaviors as appropriate or inappropriate. So these sets of values and customs they can vary tremendously, you know, from different populations, different social groups. They can vary also in the same person over time. So we have this more open the customs the. Definition of morality. Anybody say?
Yeah, you. I had a question about the integrated versus dual process idea. Is that something that if you had better temporal resolution that it would actually give information one way or the other, or would that not make any difference? Or for example, if it showed that some emotional regions
So, just to, before I answer the temporal resolution questions, one might misinterpret the concept that we oppose this idea of hierarchical control, but in a way that tells that okay, we always have say. The frontal cortex and subcortical regions acting together at the same time or in an integrative way. I think most of the times it really works like that. But of course you can in different moments be in different psychological states which can engage more or less certain subcortical or certain cortical regions depending on the state you are. The problem is the physiological mechanism. So there are no, or the evidence for cortical to subcortical inhibition systems in these emotionally relevant brain regions, so to speak, is null. So there's most of these connections. They are excitatory. What you have is inhibition. Inhibition occurs mostly in a very localized fashion, just to increase signal to noise locally in cortical processing, for example, and also at the subcortical level. One region inhibiting the neighboring one, so the basal ganglia, for example, putamen and obstrialibus. But this concept of having the prefrontal cortex inhibiting your amygdala, it doesn't, you know, it cannot operate in this way. It's very unlikely that this happens. And even if there are some neurons, some projections which are directly inhibitory, they are by far much more rare than the excitatory ones. So, and going to the temporal resolution, of course, we can use connectivity data to show that in fMRI, but we, as you know, the temporal resolution is, you know, on the order of 2 seconds or anything like that. So the real evidence should come from a method which is able to have very good spatial resolution, which EEG doesn't have, and localization, especially for subcortical regions. Even a region is not able to determine. And temporal resolution, that's a big promise. So I think maybe with MEG that would be possible. MEG evidence could, actually yesterday was, we met here another day, she was directing the MEG center. We were talking about this. So if you could have some similar tests as using the fMRI and the MEG, we could gather some evidence, or not pro or against this synchronization idea of cortical, subcortical structures.
I believe there are some scientists conducting MRI imaging on meditators, experienced meditators, and they report to the Dalai Lama once every 2 years. It's called the Mind and Life Institute. I just thought you might like to check it out, because I think mainly it's taking place in America, North America. But they're starting from the other end, and I saw you had your son doing his meditation pose.
Yeah.
So I think they found some quite interesting results, and talking about baseline, maybe a pure meditative state would be a very good baseline if subjects could be taught to achieve that.
No, I think it's doable. There are actually a few papers that came out looking at even structural changes in meditators. Seems that it can induce, you know, any kind of training, cognitive, motor, or meditation whatsoever can actually increase change functional connectivity, and can change also some anatomical at the more subtle level. And what I don't know is, of course, the role of meditation in being the, it's, I think there's enough evidence. Not enough. There is good evidence that it can help people with certain, for example, depression, vulnerability, to reduce the chances to increase the vision. And we know very little about the neurofunctional anatomy of that. But I think it's a working area for this one.
Questions? Yeah, I wanted to ask you about, it's very interesting, one of the things I was interested in finding, I thought, was connection between post-social behavior and this brain area that connect to primitive bonding and affiliation. Mm-hmm. But it's also puzzling, you know, when you engage in altruism, in a way you're relating to this maybe distant stranger, or say with something more abstract in the way that parents would relate to a child. So, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about the mechanism that is involved, or some kind of emotion identifies these groups in that kind of way, pushes you towards that behavior, whether that kind of structure really underlies cross-social behavior, so whether you might have cases where certain kind of utilitarian thinking is very cold blooded, might motivate people to, you know, 80% of those kind of rewards to others without engaging in kind of people. So could you say a little bit more on
that? I think we still don't know enough on that. You know, for example, the results, as you pointed out, if you, when we present the names of our, you know, real organizations, say Red for the World, in that study we presented the name plus a summary mission, helping children in Africa, or something like that. So I think it's kind of helped a little bit people to, you know, to focus on the objects of whom they would help, that they were supposed to help, or they could help. And but I agree that it's a very artificial, and, you know, in the scanner, listen to these noises. Still, people made the decisions, and they sacrificed several times to help these organizations. However, it's the point you raise is very interesting, because if you look at studies, such one of those I showed, even other studies showing, for example, baby faces and things like that, you have in general much more potent activation in those regions. Although these studies did not control for emotional variance, so you see activation everywhere, and you know, in the base of the brain, it doesn't discriminate between affiliation in general emotional arousal. That's the problem of other studies. But still, you see a lot of activation in these regions in a much more potent way that we see in these donation experiments, for example. And one funny thing is that the most specific responses we got for donations were actually in the subgeneral cortex and in the septal region, but the subgeneral cortex was the strongest response. And when we look at this more recent data we are acquiring with the affiliatives and the others, we get no subgeneral response, only septal region. So what is the possible thing? What's our current thinking is that we have, you know, collateral evidence to show that the subgeneral cortex is more linked to guilt or to self-reproach. And it's very likely that people, when they were making those decisions, when they actually donated, they donated out of, you know, a sense of responsibility or guilt or duty. So if you ask me, so what is the subgeneral domain? Today we think that subgeneral cortex has to do something with duty, the sense of I have to do that.
And that's very different from treating strangers as part of your family.
Yeah, exactly. And it is different from the warm glow thing. And, you know, although we saw also activation of the reward system when people donated.
Any more questions?
Sure. So I'm just wondering if you could, so if you just take a paradigm example of moral behavior, there's this famous example of a child drowning in a pond, a small bit of water, and you can rescue the child at some small cost to yourself. And, you know, people engaged in ethics and religion have a view of what's going on there. They think that we have a belief and set of moral code and conform to that. I'm wondering, as a scientist that studied moral behaviour, what do you think is going on when somebody sees a child drowning and they pick the child up? How would you describe what's going on?
Yeah, that's a... So the first point is that, you know, we see these heroic acts, so people jumping on the tracks of the subway, like recently happened in the U.S., this guy jumped, you heard about this case, right? The woman was a mom with her baby and with a stroller, and the stroller, she was distracted, the stroller just, you know, fell onto the tracks of the metro. The baby actually fell onto the metro. And this guy, total stranger, he jumped, in fact, the train was just coming, this guy jumps in the tracks. And he lies over the baby in the, you know, between the tracks, and the train goes over him. We're touched, so that he just put the baby in the middle and cover. And so these are very anecdotal things, but of course they are very real. And this interviewing, I think someone has summarized interviewed some of these people. I don't know why I saw that, but people, what they report is just that they have an immediate reaction to help. You know, it's just, you know, they don't think. They're just jumping there and without much consideration.
Now, I think these are extreme examples. I'm thinking more of the common everyday examples of moral behavior, just ordinary moral behavior. You know, when somebody helps an old lady across the road, something like that.
Yeah, okay.
What do you think? What's your analysis of that?
My analysis is that part of that is triggered by could be compassion, could be guilt. I really believe these more emotions are operating there. But as we were discussing, actually, I think we were lunch. I believe that this exercise of you know, good deeds, and once you exercise these and you become habits, you know, it makes easier because you have all the scripts that your prefrontal cortex represents. It represents all these, you know, this being nice and saying and helping someone to, you know, when someone drops things, and so I think it becomes highly scripted in a way. And if you don't have these scripts, you might not help because you don't know what to do actually, but you have this very automatic scripts. It becomes much easier, even not thinking about it, even not being totally moved by the situation, but to engage in this helping scripts. And I think that's something that is really stored in the prefrontal cortex, in the medial prefrontal cortex. Sequence of helping actions, for example. It's still unstudied, so one should design a study to look at, engage in scripts of helping. I would bet that you get these huge activations on the medial prefrontal cortex, these scripts.
And one of the limits of neural imaging is that you get a picture of what's going on in the processing brain at one time, but there's no immediate data about the cause of the process landing in that capacity or disposition. And that which might be, the response might be extremely simple, but the process landing that George said was, might be extremely long and complex.
Halfway through your speech, you made the point that you didn't want to nail down a philosophical position on what is morality. But as a result of doing the empirical work, do you think that any one of a number of positions are supported empirically? So do you find that the empirical stuff is actually starting to look like it supports a particular philosophical position?
I can't say, because there's so much confusion. If you look at this, for example, I would say that this sentimentalist view, for this kind of data makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Sentimentalism, of course. But at the same time, so if you say utilitarian consequentialist view also makes sense, but I don't believe at all that it's a rationalizing, because that's a debate we had before and with other people, is that if you're looking at consequences, if you really care about the consequences, it's a highly emotional thing. It's not a rational, only a rational decision. Of course, you have to entertain which is the possible consequences, the collateral effects, and of course you can engage several cognitive abilities. But in the end, if you're actually morally, if you have a real concern, you engage in the systems equally. And regarding the ontology, I think it's the same thing, because what is the real neural or psychological? Nobody really explored even the psychological correlates of the categorical imperative, for example. What is that? Is this a real rational thing, or is it belief, highly densely belief, and therefore emotional thing? Because believing in something is extremely powerful.
You mentioned the sort of consequentialist maths that you can go through. And I don't know enough about fMRI, but is there a sense in which you can detect activity in a part of the brain that is doing the maths before you actually get the activation in the moral areas, or not? Because presumably if you could detect that...
No, this thing happens too fast.
Okay.
And I think, you can build a scenario in which you must make very complicated calculations before you make a decision. But then you're not in a moral state of mind. You're just making calculations, and after that, now you engage in moral thinking or in more emotional thinking. But you have to do something else before. I think the calculations are sufficiently complex. And then you engage, of course, the supramarginal gyres, the left one, and this should pick up in activation. But I wouldn't think that. I think it doesn't solve the issue of consequentialism. It just it just adds math before your moral thinking.
I just wanted to pick up on the earlier question about how we, your comments about how we come to have these scripts about how to respond in a moral kind of way. And And I wonder whether we've ever looked at developmentally at the activation of these areas, how that might change with age, particularly in children or even in adults, as we learn more about what it is to behave morally in a particular social and cultural environment.
Yeah, there are a couple of papers. One of them was done. I participated in this study by helping with the designing the task, but it was conducted by Burnett from and UCL, and she did a moral judgment task, no, a moral emotion task on kids ranging from, I think it's from 9 to 16 or something in this range, and then if I remember well, the findings are that if, when you go over time, you know, with age, the kids tend to activate when they are younger more the prefrontal cortex and less the geotemporal, and over time you engage less the prefrontal cortex and more you have more activation of the your temporal cortex. That's one possible interpretation, is that the complexity of the scenario for the same, you know, as you evolve, you have much more efficient script knowledge, and then you use less the frontal cortex because it's like an immediate solution to that. So your temporal cortex actually stores more complex and conceptual information of the scenario. But this is still very preliminary, but it's a very interesting area. The difficulty is to adapt. You have to change your scenarios over age, and then you don't know exactly, you know, how, you know, what are the ingredients of the scenarios, how they differ from, and how they should be adapted for each age. So it's very difficult, a very tough area to do research, but very important.
More questions? We can release the close and thank Jordan Moll again.